Reinhard Wolf, sitting in for Henrik Palmgren, and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. Red Ice is an alternative media outlet that covers issues neglected by the mainstream. Our brand new members website is nearing completion, so be on the lookout for that. Our guests for today are Titus Flavius and Rudolf von Fugel. Both are contributors to the Tales from the Trough podcast, which can be found at hyperboreum.com. Titus is also the host of Kulturkampf, a podcast focused on philosophy and literature. Welcome to Red Ice, Titus and Rudolf. How are you guys doing this evening?
Doing well, sir. Glad to be back.
Yeah, doing great. Thanks for having me.
Great. So I wanted to have you guys on for a more lighthearted show, so I chose some of the most absurd stories from this past week. You know, since we live in clown world, essentially it wasn't particularly hard to procure stories, for such a theme. So first I want to start off by discussing the Huffington Post article that recently came out about Alexander Dugin. But before we get into the actual article itself, what do either of you have to say about Alexander Dugin?
Well, I actually haven't read much of Dugin. I have his book on Heidegger, which is collecting dust in my on the shelf at the moment. But he's someone that I do want to explore. So in terms of any critiques or remarks regarding his pan-Europeanism and pan-Eurasianism,
and
sort of fourth political theology. I pretty much.
That's okay. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No.
Yeah.
I am somewhat drawn to him as a figure because from just seeing some of his videos and the like, he comes across as someone who's trying to give the sort of look and the presentation of like the old timey Russian mystic, right? In terms of not as sort of grotesque and sort of horrific as Rasputin, but he certainly is in that vein.
Yeah, well, Rasputin is the first person that comes to mind, but I think Alexander Dugin is a little more trad, for a lack of a better better word. Dugin is, so the fourth political theory is what he's perhaps best known for. I believe that's. It's not an actual theory. That book was him opening up kind of the conversation to develop whatever will become the fourth political theory. Because the first three were Marxism, fascism, including National Socialism, and then liberalism. So what I understand to be the case with him is that he kind of draws from all of those. And, he critiques, and he looks at the pros and cons, essentially. But I want to read a little bit from this article that I found to be interesting. So granted, all of the kind of intellectualism that we were just discussing for a second, this is Huffington Post attempting to enter into, this level of intellectual discourse. So the article kind of starts off talking about Atlantis. Apparently, Alexander Dugin believes in, Atlantis, in, kind of these ancient, in Hyperborea, all of this, borderline mythological, ancient Aryan kind of stuff that I find interesting. Who knows if it's true, but it seemed like a kind of a weird place for them to start off when discussing Dugin, because I rarely hear that associated with him. But towards the middle of the article, there's a bit that I want to read. It says, Putin's Russia, under Dugin's influence, is actively working to undermine people's faith in their governments in Europe and the United States in order to bring about their destabilization. So we've heard this before. Putin's obviously, supposedly pulling the strings behind every, political party in the West that's right of center. But so at one point, the article names organizations that are being encouraged or funded by Putin. And they name, the Eurasian Youth Union, the Eurasian Observatory, and U.S.-based group Identity Europa. So I'm a member of Identity Europa, and I was unaware that we are being funded by Putin, who's in turn being manipulated by Alexander Dugin. So what do the two of you think about this this new revelation?
Well, I guess it is interesting to note that this sort of line of critique in terms of painting anyone to the right of, you know, standard, you know, political GOP as a pawn of Dugin and Russia, that it's interesting that that narrative is not only being employed by the Huffington Post, but National Review and Glenn Beck as well, because I know Glenn Beck went on a tear when he learned who Dugin was,
right?
And made all these sorts of accusations.
Well, he called him a Satanist, didn't he? And basically, sort of all of the things that would have been more mystically oriented, like you were talking about Reinhardt with Atlantis and the origins of the Aryan race, etc. And he kind of just dumbed it down and was like, oh, no, he's just a Satanist. And all his other ideas, whether there's merit to them or not, it's actually just evil. So you shouldn't even think about it or look into it.
Yeah, it's very typical for them to label something with a bad or scary name. I guess Nazi wasn't applicable or wasn't scary enough in this instance. He had to, you know, draw upon the Satan, the Prince of Darkness. I mean, maybe that's the future for all right wingers. We're just going to be labeled Satanists, which would be
Reinhardt, that ties into exactly the line of attack that, as you said, Huffington Post opened up with, right? Which is a critique of sort of these concepts, these images of what can be boiled down to whether or not you believe in an actual Atlantis or Hyperborea. What they are, in truth, are concepts, right? They're images of a spiritual side of the ideology that we're working and living in. So having the Huffington Post critique it through the secular left, right? Because they're basically just, you know, sort of highlighting those sort of topics, and using sort of their big brained, science wow snark to sort of, you know, immediately sort of paint Dugin and people like us as kooks. Whereas, Glenn Beck, in the air of sort of evangelical Christianity, uses those same topics, uses those same pieces of Dugin's philosophy, and paints it uses it as a critique fueled by sort of Christianity and his Mormonism.
Yeah, definitely. They're looking for a scapegoat, and they're looking for ways to do anything but actually engage with real ideas, real arguments, and real positions. And they're very creative at doing so.
Isn't Dugin, from what little I know about him, doesn't he advocate the kind of like bringing about of an end times through like conscious effort and conscious practice, like crushing what America has become and propping up like a some form of authoritarian government in its place?
Yeah, I think his big thing is that liberalism needs to die. And I'm not going to disagree with that. That doesn't necessarily make me a Eurasianist. I'm not completely sure what that would entail. But I think he does have some end times views. I'm not familiar with all of them. His Wikipedia article is really hilarious because, in true Wikipedia fashion, they pick out the most controversial and bombastic quotes that they can. I think it's towards the end. They have one line. It's like, Alexander Dugin has also recommended banning the internet.
That's something that I'm totally in favor of, to be perfect.
Yeah, I mean, there needs to...
After we win, of course.
Right. Banning the internet for the masses. I mean, we've all seen just the terrible content on Twitter coming out of, from the left, even from boomers. I mean, these people, they're just not cut out for the internet, right? They're not cut out to make good tweets, essentially, is what it boils down to. So, I mean, if banning the internet for most people is a way to avoid, to prevent me from being subjected to bad content, then, I mean, I might start identifying as a Duganist.
becoming the arbiter of taste Like that is the prime objective.
Yes.
Whether we know it or not, ethnostate and all that stuff, that's secondary, guys. We need to become the arbiters of taste.
Yeah, aesthetic totalitarianism.
Yes.
Well, I mean, it's kind of funny. Isn't that, like, except for the death of liberalism, it kind of seems like Huffington Post would kind of be all for Dugin's ideas, you know, even if they wouldn't admit it consciously.
You think so?
Well, I mean, maybe, because there's that inherent contradiction with how they view America. They're like, oh, America is evil, it's a white supremacist organization.
True.
America is also the golden city, you know, shining on top of the hill, and everybody needs to come here.
Yeah, actually, that is a very interesting critique. I think, yeah, we're pretty much either in or entering into a post-liberal age. You know, if you're a liberal at this point and you actually support free speech for everyone, then, like, you're some kind of crazy right-winger, whereas, you know, even like 10 to 20 years ago, the average liberal Democrat would support that. But now we're at a point where, yeah, it's these kind of liberal ideals are looked upon as supporting, you know, people whom the left hates, you know, essentially us at the end of the day, in Trump. So, yeah, I mean, they're both looking at both, you know, the Huffington Post aristocracy and Alexander Dugin are looking at liberalism as something that is undesirable, but for, yeah, you know, very different reasons. One thing, I think Eurasianism is an interesting idea. My understanding of it is that it's essentially recognizing that Russia and related countries are, they're not Asian, but they're not European. So they're kind of, you know, they're kind of in between. And I think it's a way of looking at, you know, themselves and kind of just viewing the world in terms of large, you know, civilizational spaces. But, yeah, obviously Eurasianism and Duginism, I think for some in the right, you know, even in the alt-right is kind of, it's kind of a specter as well of, you know, the, you know, the incoming, you know, Eurasian empire that they don't want to be part of. But anyways, yeah.
So it's like it's sort of like a fascist Hapa empire. Is that correct? It kind of seems, I don't know, pretty close. Sheila posted.
Yeah.
Wow, it's pretty close.
Yeah, well, I mean, if Elliot Rodger is any indication, I think a fascist Hapa empire would be pretty free from thoughts. So, again, between banning the internet and this, I'm starting to appreciate Alexander Dugin. I'm starting to become a believer.
Yeah, we've got some reading to do in either case.
Yeah. Definitely. So I want to switch gears to talk about another man who is perhaps equally powerful and intellectually domineering. So this man has been taking the right wing by storm lately by employing historical revisionism. This visionary has been essentially destroying the left and flipping the entire left-right paradigm upside down. And, of course, I'm talking about Dinesh D'Souza. So I want to kind of go through some of his very – well, let's – before we go into the individual things that he's been saying as of late. For anyone unfamiliar, this is, you know, an Indian conservative – Indian-American conservative, sorry. But he essentially – his whole thing is he has taken Democrats with the real racists and he has made a brand out of it. He essentially wrote a book about it and it's now just, you know – spreading all kinds of absurdities around that theme to sell his book. The book is called, I believe it's The Big Lie, The Nazi Roots of the Left.
Oh, my God.
So before I kind of open it up for discussion, I want to read some of his bad takes. I have two in particular. It's kind of hard to keep up with all of them. I was scrolling through his Twitter feed, and they were literally all bad takes. But here are some choice ones. Nothing in Mussolini's fascist regime compares to this systematic segregation and racial terrorism sponsored by the U.S. Democratic Party.
So true.
Yeah. Nazi racism was more murderous than democratic racism, yet Nazi racism lasted 12 years, while democratic racism lasted over 100 years. Hashtag the big lie. So, wow, that's a lot to take in. What are your thoughts on Dinesh D'Souza?
I'd be angrier with Dinesh if it wasn't for the fact that his entire fan base will be dead in 10 years.
Very true.
You know,
very true.
He's not reaching the minds of the young people, right, with this claptrap. So I guess it's a positive for us, right?
Does he even have any fans, or do people just tolerate him?
I don't know, man. That stuff sells to the boomers. They like it. I mean, if you look at the replies to these tweets, there are a lot of very, very happy boomers. They're happy that someone's finally pointing out that Democrats are the real racists. I mean, it's just, I said this on a previous show. Part of me isn't like, I don't really get upset at this stuff. Part of me is almost in like,
no.
Can appreciate from like an entrepreneurial perspective. Dinesh just saw that there's like this niche in the market for, you know, Dems are the real racist content. And he wrote a book about it, and he's just driving it home. And he finds like these strange ways to, he's always finding like new bizarre takes on like the whole issue. It's just,
there's a pureness in his stupidity and in his graft that I can't help but admire. And it's one thing to say like, oh, you know, without, you know, having any sort of understanding of sort of the political and sort of change that occurred in terms of like the Republican and Democrat Party from pre-Civil War to post-Civil War, and then Nixon's Southern Strategy and all that. Like, you can be totally illiterate on that and still come up with this nonsense. It's another thing entirely to try and link National Socialism to the Democratic Party. I mean, it absolutely is just,
well,
beyond absurd.
Yeah, I mean, Titus,
well, hey, man, the Klan, they were Democratic.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I don't think Titus is really aware of all of this. Titus, did you know that John F. Kennedy actually said that fascism works pretty well for Germany and Italy?
You know, in fact, I did know this, and this was actually one of the talking points that I raised when I told my parents that I was a National Socialist. I brought up JFK's quote. So,
and your parents were Democrats, and they were like, "Okay, I can relate to that because I am a Democrat." Yeah, National Socialism is a little moderate. It's not full blown Democrat. You know, you're not a full blown Democrat, but we can work with that, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Titus had to promise that he was also really a trans black woman. So that was the compromise. That's the only way they were able to accept it.
Well,
I know you didn't want me to say that, Titus.
Okay. Cat's out of the bag now, man.
Yeah, well, I mean, wow, congratulations on the transition. I mean, the last time I saw you, you were not, it was that a trans black woman. You very much look like a white male, so you've done some real work in the meantime.
Well,
so.
You can't see me, dear friends,
I can't
and,
see
and
you.
Dear listeners, but I am sarcastically rolling my eyes in the vein of a sarcastic black woman. So,
well, there you go.
You guys know that I'm on point.
Yeah, actually, speaking of, So speaking of transgenders, there's this picture of a tranny, I guess it's just a cross-dressing Antifa going around, you know, and the one picture, someone found his Instagram, in one picture he's dressed up in all black, and he's holding the gun, and he's got some, you know, random Antifa or whatever flags behind him. And then a few pictures later there, it's him, and keep in mind this is a, you know, kind of, he's still beta, but he's got a beard, and he's hairy man in a dress. And so I believe it was James Woods who posted, you know, those two pictures juxtaposed next to each other and said something about, like, now we know why they wear all black and masks, as if they're all secretly trannies behind there. Whatever, I mean, that's not as bad of a tweet as a boomer could compose. But
just an aside, like,
yeah.
James Wood, like, the work that James Wood is doing to rehabilitate the boomer generation is really just impressive. And just a shout out to Mr. Woods, because he's getting me to kind of like boomers now, and it's somewhat dangerous, and I'm not comfortable with it, but.
I think it was all of his, like, interactions with John Carpenter just kind of rubbed off on him.
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah, well, I mean, you don't want to get too too close to the boomers. Once we, you know, once we get in charge, we're going to have to put them, we're going to have to put them in camps, frankly. I mean, if for no other reason than so that I don't have to see these really just god awful memes that they love to post. I mean, it's,
well, partition Florida. Florida can be the boomer access.
That's where they all live anyways, right?
Yeah. They won't have to move.
All right. Yeah. Well, I mean, Florida listeners, if you're sorry, you know, you have to, you're going to have to take one for the team. So when you
sacrifices will be made in order to achieve victory.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll write you a postcard. I'm sure they'll postcards will be quite common in the Florida boomer ethno state. But back to the tweet that I was talking about. So James Wood, the tweet about the Antifa tranny. Well, Dinesh D'Souza comes along and he quote retweets that and says, well, that has a, or he said something about it having a lot in common with the brown shirts, which is kind of funny. And your tranny comment earlier reminded me of that. But that one's perhaps a little hitting a little closer to the truth. I don't know if there's a history of brown shirts being cross-dressers, but we all do know that Ernst Röhm and others were a bit, shall we say, a bit implicit in their tastes and so forth. So maybe Dinesh is really maybe he's starting to get it. I don't know.
He's really hitting home, yeah, on those critiques. Absolutely. I mean, it wasn't anything like, yeah, well, yeah. The essay is a topic that.
go down that rabbit hole, but
it's like Himmler did nothing wrong.
Okay, so I think real quick maybe we should bring it back to a slightly more serious note, so we don't let Dinesh D'Souza, get off easy. And I'm sure he's listening to this podcast and he's really looking for validation. So we don't want to give it to him. So let's briefly talk about why the idea of Nazis and fascists being like the real left wing or whatever is patently absurd. Rudolf, why don't you kind of tell us your thoughts on that?
Well, like, I get where people are coming from, in that, you know, the Nazis were national socialists, right? So you have the whole socialist part. But nowadays, with any kind of nationalism, it's going to be implicitly white. Right, in America. Like, that's why we're here. That's why we're doing what we're doing.
Right.
And what was the Generation Z shakedown in the most recent election? Was it like 86% voted Trump, 14 Hillary, something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I think that was pretty close to what it was.
Yeah, and I mean, most people that are like our age and younger are aware of all the Nazi memes and everything, and they just don't care anymore, you know? And they have, I don't know, Titus, help me out here. I'm not too sure about the Nazis or the real Dems or the real Libs or the real racists. I'm not sure how it's working out.
I guess the question regarding socialism, like this comes to the question of whether or not socialism is a left or right wing phenomenon, right, in terms of ideology. The modern conception of socialism being left wing is actually fairly new, right? And it's tied explicitly to Marxism and communism. Like, the history of socialism pre-Marx and even post-Marx is inherently right-wing. And you can even go into socialist countries, right? And I'm not talking about, like, sort of the Western democracies, but I'm talking about the USSR and Venezuela and North Korea. You wouldn't consider them, yes, they are communist countries, yes, they are socialist countries, but their pathos and national spirit is inherently right-wing. They're not talking about, you know, gender-neutral bathrooms. They're not talking about intersectionality. They're not talking about any of the memes that we associate, or the memes, I guess you can I'll give them the benefit of the doubt and call it an ideology. You won't hear any of the points argued from leftists in this country and in the West in general coming from those coming from those areas. Socialism, in my opinion, is it's not just, oh, it's national socialism because it's national, because it's nationalist, it's inherently right wing. I would make the case, and I believe that the case can be made strongly, that socialism as a economic system is an inherently right wing phenomenon. So his entire premise, D'Souza's entire premise, is completely false.
Interesting. Yeah, that's definitely a very very thoughtful perspective on the subject. I think it's also worth pointing out that, you know, what is considered right wing or left wing is historically relevant, right?
Yes.
I mean that's the biggest thing that really amuses me about Dinesh D'Souza. Is the fact that he is a classical liberal. I would imagine that is conservative, which is essentially classical liberalism. Mm. That is what I would imagine he identifies as. And if you go back to the origins of the right-left split, that was during the, correct me if I'm wrong here, Titus, but during the French Revolution, the original leftists were the classical liberals, the supporters of Enlightenment values. They sat on the left of the National Assembly, and they were opposed to, what was considered right at that time was the traditional order in Europe, which was essentially monarchy and Catholicism, more or less. Mm-hmm. Right, so Dinesh D'Souza is his ideology was the birth of leftism. I understand today that it's considered right-wing, but that's because things have only moved to the left since the French Revolution, which is an interesting subject and one that could be, the subject for another show, perhaps. But and also it's worth noting that Dinesh D'Souza is only looking at economic factors, right? He is, most people, when they're talking about right and left, you talk about being economically, right wing or left wing, and then you have socially right wing or left wing. There's no one like National Socialism, Italian Fascism. Socially, these things were, they were very right wing, right? They were all about blood and soil. They were all about traditional families, traditional gender roles. Fascism in general was kind of a way to, it was kind of a modernist take on, like, trying to bring together modernism and traditionalism by, romanticizing, tanks and the modern military and so forth. But
there's also the I think you're getting close to this, the aesthetic concerns that are inherent to
absolutely
the Nazis, and that is just completely non-existent in relation to anybody on the right or the left in America, except for us. Honestly, like, everyone has horrible taste. They do not know. They don't know how to tell the difference between something that looks good and something that looks neutral and or bad, right? And that has to be some sort of spiritual sickness or some just absolute lack of humanity, to just want to surround yourself with garbage and not even try to make anything better. I mean,
yeah, that's a very good point. Aesthetically, fascism and National Socialism are far more in line with, the real right, or the origins of what was considered to be right wing at the origins of the split, which is, traditionalism, classicism, and so forth. Did you have anything more to add on that, Titus?
Yeah, I would. I think you guys touched on a very important point in that what is the main differentiation between what can be considered sort of normicon, right, classical liberalism, and the far right. Yes, you can talk about the role of government. Yes, you can talk about economic concerns. But the chief arbiter of differentiation is materialism versus spiritualism, National Socialism. Speaking as a National Socialist, National Socialism is less of an ideology and more of a spiritual bond. And fascism had this all far right ideologies. You can look to Cotterneau's The Iron Guard. They were deeply, deeply rooted in spirituality. They were deeply, deeply rooted in the esoteric, in religion, in faith. And it is the melding between the political and the spiritual, between spirituality and the temporal, that separates sort of the nominal right wing and the true right. And you can make that, you can make the same case between monarchists and liberals as well, because it has the similar divide.
Yeah, I think that's very worthwhile to point out the spiritual and the materialistic differences between the right and the left. Well, I think we've discredited Dinesh D'Souza's entire worldview and his entire brand that he's developed for himself at this point. So,
do we? And I just want to say, like, yeah. Do we even have to like bring up like the big lie, like how like he hasn't read Mein Kampf, he doesn't understand like everyone who's listened. Who's listening to this knows, like, what the big lie is about, what Hitler was referring to. It's not about the policies and propaganda of National Socialists. It's regarding the Hebrew, but whatever, you know.
Yeah.
That bugs me.
Yeah, yeah, no, I actually hadn't even thought that far into it. I was just kind of amused. I was so satisfied with the surface level debunking of Dinesh D'Souza's worldview. And it's funny, because I saw him... He was calling out some other lame, like, verified Twitter user for not, like, debating him on this stuff, but, like, I would like to see him debate someone in the alt-right or, you know, a neo-reactionary on this stuff. He never would.
I've tagged him. I've sent maybe a dozen tweets his way telling him to come on my show and debate whether or not National Socialism is left-wing or not. And I have no response.
You know, one thing I will say, too, is if Dinesh D'Souza, who, again, is certainly listening to this podcast... is afraid of taking on Titus Flavius, host of Kulturkampf, in a battle of the minds. There are other ways that we could settle this debate, and one of them, I think, is we could arrange we could rent a tropical island somewhere, and we could arrange a cage fighting match between Dinesh D'Souza and Bronze Age Pervert. I think that would settle this debate once and for all. But so Dinesh, the ball is in your court, my friend. Feel free to take us up on either or two of those offers. All right. Well, let's move on. Let's talk about this article that you brought to my attention, Titus. Why don't you just kind of start us off with that?
Right. So this our good friend. Douche, and that's his username. That's not an epithet hurled at him. He's a good man and fellow oven men. Posted this on the TRS forum, and it is from a feminist website called Bust, and that is take whatever snarky joke that you can make from that title of the website, and it's regarding the death positive movement, which is a burgeoning sort of part of feminism that's just starting up, and it's interested explicitly in women in the death industry and sort of the new fetish that I think is going to be on the horizons of the left, and that is the final taboo is death itself. Now, you might think off the bat that this is an article talking about like the merits and beauty of suicide and like it actually isn't. Much of the article I actually agree with in that it is a critique of the modern what you can call over one of the last holdovers of sort of Anglo conceptions of society, which is sort of our separation. With death, how we sort of treat it as a commodity and sort of pay, you know, ridiculous amounts of money to these funeral businesses. A lot of the article actually brings up a lot of topics that I actually agree with personally, in that it is a critique of the modern conception of death in America, as well as an attack on the funeral industry. And this is a holdover from my libertarian days, I guess, which is the modern funeral industry is pretty much a scam. You chalk over vast amounts of money, and it's all just some sort of sick, materialized, ritual. It's become commodified. It's very much latched onto, you know, capitalism and the free market. And a lot of the things that they're purporting, a lot of these feminist politicians are advocating for a return to the historical sort of views and practices of death, which is home burials, and things that I actually agree with, because it's something that isn't a commodity. It's something that is rooted in family and in community. And by and large, this article actually is pretty decent, and it holds some pretty fair critiques of the funeral industry and how we as a society view and treat death. The issue comes up when these feminists have to inject their ideology into it. And I have a few choice quotes that I'd like to read out. So, the melding of activism and the death positive movement is something the women behind Death and the Maiden are focused on as well. When I post a picture of a sugar skull or a cemetery during Dia de los Muertos, it gets dozens of likes, says Chavez, whose Chicana heritage influences her work. However, when I post something about the violent death of a brown or black person, I will immediately lose about 100 followers. I find it very revealing. It's wonderful to find beauty in death. Artists, poets and writers have been doing this for centuries. However, to acknowledge only certain aspects of death is to reinforce the very thing we are trying desperately to change. If your death awareness... That's just awful right there. If your death awareness doesn't include the people and issues that affect the most vulnerable and marginalized, then you are perpetuating death denial. It just as intersectionality is crucial to feminism, it's also imperative for the death positive movement. This is a movement about something all human beings experience. It is pointless if it isn't inclusive, she says. So,
wow.
There you go, right off the bat.
Wow, a lot to unpack there, huh?
Yes.
So I mean, I guess death is kind of oppressive and stuff, right?
Also, I find it kind of interesting and sadly predictable that all of these women look like a bad Betty Page caricatures.
Yes.
You know,
that's something
it's not about the aesthetic. It's about the deep underlying issues. I don't just get into death because then there's this whole cool kind of like dark, mysterious Morticia look I can get into, you know.
Well, yeah. If anything, leftists are never considered about never consider aesthetical concerns, right? So the fact that they all have the same haircut, that they all have the same horn-rimmed glasses, and the fact that they all have dead eyes is not indicative of some sort of aesthetical aspirations. It's actually just a mirror into their souls, right? This is how you accurately pathologize these types of people.
Yeah, I mean, they think you know, these death positivists or whatever, they think that you know, that men have, you know, the patriarchy has been oppressing people's way of, you know, interacting with death. You know, gender as well as race and privilege plays a large role in determining our relationship to and experience of death and dying. For so long, men have restricted our access to opportunities and spaces that have a direct impact on the quality of our lives. So the patriarchy is really just ruining people's deaths. Like, we take these women, and just because we hate women, right, we just force them to do terrible things like have kids and not, you know, do drugs and have promiscuous sex. And at the end, we don't even let them die how they want. I mean, that's just, wow, that's terrible.
Here's the thing, Rudolph, and I'm sorry. Here's the thing, Reinhard. They're half right, right? If you're talking about sort of the patriarchy and that like ever elusive term, right? This specter that haunts these women. They're kind of accurate, because if you view the funeral industry as the patriarchy, then they're totally right, because it is an abusive system. The fact is, though, that it's an abusive system not because it's dominated by men. It's an abusive system because it's dominated by capitalism. and it's dominated by the I can only consider as sort of this Anglo sort of Protestant view towards death, which is basically, you know, mask it in frivolity, mask it in just sort of goods, a really expensive casket, all this stuff that is totally materialistic, totally lacks any sort of spirituality or community, and charge a high fee for it. So, viewing the funeral industry in a negative light and critiquing it actually is, I would say, totally, totally warranted. And it's something that in a society that I'd want to live in, we'd have natural deaths. We would have natural funerals, you know?
Yeah, I think that is pretty fair. But yeah, blaming it on the patriarchy is pretty bad. And you know, it's funny that they don't blame it on capitalism. At least they didn't, because that's one of those safe things to criticize for them. It's kind of the go-to thing. You know, if there's something wrong, then it's, you know, it's capitalism, right? But yeah, I mean, this is wow. Death positivity is it's going to be a big driving force in the future. I can tell already.
It is the final taboo. Right. I mean, we've gotten to the point, where polyamory and polygamy are now heralded as the bright future in the New York Times. What else is there, really? I mean, it's pedophilia and death. It's pretty much.
Yeah, I think that maybe they're getting burned out on the sex stuff. I mean, that's kind of like a niche they've been pushing for so long. You know, it's. They say variety is the spice of life, so maybe just they'll hold off on pedophilia and bestiality. They'll go for, decolonizing death or whatever they're going to call it. And
yeah. Is there like a specific kind of like a gay death? Yeah. Like a gender queer.
The possibilities are endless for this kind of postmodern. Theorizing and so forth. I mean, decolonizing death, that totally could be like someone's dissertation about how, I mean, what would the premise for that be? The premise would be that non-white people in white societies are forced to have funerals in the way that the white man wants. That person, I mean, that's if you're listening to this and you're looking for a career, there you go. You could make a killing out of that.
If you want to be like a trad, like African, and celebrate your roots, these people, like, they may or may not realize this, but like the, at least in Uganda, the funeral rites did involve cannibalism. So huzzah for that.
That is another tap.
But there's actually a lot of like health benefits to a cannibalism.
Yeah, especially if you eat the brain, it has some really good vitamins, minerals.
That's how you acquire knowledge.
Yeah, yeah, that's secret knowledge.
That's the only reason how I can understand Rick and Morty. To be perfectly honest, if I don't feed on a brain once a week, I'm never.
So does that make your brain bigger when you if you want to have one of those galaxy sized brains that we see in all the Twitter memes? You have to consume brains. Is that what you're telling me?
That's the esoteric truth behind that meme, is that all those memes actually involve cannibalism right beforehand. So,
well, I've never consumed brain, so that probably explains why I have such a small brain, frankly. So it's good to know that that's something I can improve upon.
Well, self-improvement. Well, let's not get into that, because self-improvement's fascist. So.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. When you're eating brains, you don't want to be a fascist, right? interestingly, there was... do you guys know who Reza Aslan is? He's one of these liberal Islam apologists. He went over to India and he ate brains as part... I think it was part of like a CNN documentary or something. And people have just been like constantly referencing that every time they get into an argument with them on Twitter, like, you've literally eaten human brains, like, on camera. Why should I, you're a psychopath, why should I care about anything you have to say? So that is something to keep in mind as well, if you're gonna eat human brains to expand your own brain, is that these unenlightened plebeians in society will they're not going to really understand. See,
yeah,
they're not going to get it.
I don't know. I don't know that I believe that he ate the brains, because if he really ate the brains and he really gained the knowledge bump,
right,
he would have found a way, some kind of rhetoric to use to get around them.
Yeah, he would have been able to
I think
stomp
lying.
Them.
They're just lying again all the time.
Yeah,
fake
that's
news.
True.
He didn't eat brains.
He ate porridge or something.
Yeah.
Although I guess porridge doesn't really look like brains, but that's okay.
They probably tricked him and made him pay like $1,200.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone's interested in looking into that, it's Reza Aslan and the Hindu sect known for eating brains. They're called the Agora. They're a left-hand path form of Tantra, and they're, as with all left-hand path practices, they're all about antinomianism. And that does involve, like, you know, eating brains and, you know, even eating other parts of the human body. Now, yeah, in all seriousness, that's a massive health risk, and I don't think that will confer any special abilities upon you. But, you know, it's each his own, as they say, right? But
well, I mean, like, to
live and let live.
Sick, like, being sick and unhealthy is a special power. So it depends on who you're talking to.
Yeah. That's true. That's kind of like, do you guys know what the name of the condition is when you eat someone's brain and then you consume, are they called prions? There's some particle in the human brain that if you eat, it will give you a special disease. I forget the name of it, but, I'm thinking that maybe that's like similar to bug chasing. This is like the big brain version.
Big brain chasing.
Brain chasing. Okay, well, that was good. I'm glad we covered that. So building off of this kind of, you know, feminist death liberation theory nonsense, so it looks like they are going to be doing a all-female version of Lord of the Flies. So are either of you experts on Lord of the Flies, or do you have any, you know, insightful comments about this feminist take?
Are we talking about Beelzebub or the William Golding? No, I didn't have to read Lord of the Flies in eighth grade with everybody else, so I just have the SparkNotes version,
nice,
kind of in my pop culture brain.
What if you?
Yeah,
what about you, Titus?
I read it in eighth grade. I read it when I was a kid. I haven't reread it. It's from what I recall. It's all about. Is it a critique of social Darwinism? I think it is.
I've got a tweet up here from a guy that looks pretty progressive, and he says, Lord of the Flies is about the replication of systemic masculine toxicity.
I'm glad you touched on that. That was a point that I wanted to touch on. I've been looking at kind of some of the left's reviews or not reviews, I guess it's not out yet, kind of their responses to an all-female Lord of the Flies movie. And I'm sure the people coming up with this thought that this was going to be great, everyone was going to love how progressive it is, and, you know, they're just imagining all the signaling they're going to be able to do, but not enough. All-female cast for social justice reasons, not for, you know, because this is someone's artistic vision. That wasn't enough. The movie, the book and of course the movie are about toxic masculinity. So putting women in that role, it's a bit problematic. One thing that the left has been upset about regarding this new Lord of the Flies film is that it was, it's starring all women, but it's written by two men.
Well, I'm sure they're like uber, like
masculine,
just masculine,
macho
men, but, like, go to the gym.
And they're just making this all female version of Lord of the Flies for sex appeal, right? Because when I talk to liberals about putting, you know, women in, replacing women with, you know, in male roles in movies, it's not they don't think that it's social justice. It's always sex appeal, right? I think that's kind of a funny narrative that they're kind of unwilling to perhaps admit that there's more institutional power and hegemony to their ideas, but go on.
Well, no, that's exactly what I was going to bring up, right? Because no one's talking about the economic concerns of this, right? Because the only reason why this was greenlit was because Hunger Games is a thing, right? And Hunger Games is all about a strong independent female, like, killing what I'm assuming is other strong independent females. I've never read the books or saw the movies, but I know of their cultural importance to sort of pop culture. And the fact that this is also another adaptation of a novel, which is another sort of cue in the long, terrible death of originality in Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, it's just claptrap, right? It's all, you know, it's
claptrap.
This is Hollywood. Yeah. This is the Hollywood machine at work, right?
Yeah.
Hollywood.
Well, machine. I mean, there's also the secondary attempt to sort of like retcon our cultural artifacts, you know, even if they do it in like a really kind of ham-fisted sort of juvenile way, like they did with Ghostbusters. It's the same deal. They're like, oh, just, and I think, what's his name? Diversity in comics.
Mm.
He's not really like our guy, but I mean, he talks about the whole way that, you know, comics have just been like blatantly, I don't know, what's the opposite of whitewashed? Like rainbow washed? They've been brownwashed, and it's just kind of in an arbitrary fashion, so that you just take a character and you make them a different race, or you swap their gender.
Yeah,
and it's you don't change anything inherently about the character, and they just are like, oh, there you go, and then they like brush the dust off their hands, and they just think everything's okay, and they just once again it's back to them having no inherent understanding of a narrative structure or how content relates to reality.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
it harkens...
Go on.
Oh, no, well, it just harkens to the Yaki quote regarding what, like, feminism is nothing but an ideology that strives to make women like men, right? It's just a...
Yeah, lesser versions of men. That's ultimately like what it is. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, regarding kind of the artistic perspective from all of this, you know, kind of... Let's say that even if we, the three of us, didn't have these kind of far right political views, I think doing things like making an all female cast is, I mean, that's one thing. Like, I would not necessarily be opposed to an all female movie if it had an interesting premise and if there was a reason for them all to be female, other than, you know, the author or, you know, the film's like writers, you know, director and so forth, were doing it for social justice reasons. To me, that just, again, removing politics from the equation, that's very just artistically illegitimate. I mean, that's you're not sticking to like a real vision, especially when it's a revamp of something that's already existing. You're taking something that someone else already made. You're saying, hey, we're going to take this classic and we're just going to, you know, twist a few minor things, really. I doubt any of the... You know, the plot is really going to change all that much, and we're just going to change it to make it, you know, less problematic. That's not art. That's just claptrap, as you put it.
It signals to the nature of the modern left, right, which is very much rooted unconsciously in Bolshevism, right, and Maoism, in that the past always has to conform to the present, right? It's an overused line from 1984, but we've always been at war with Eurasia, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's something that is totally true and totally when you view sort of the cultural manipulations and perversions of what's happening, whether it be in comic books or film and TV adaptations. It doesn't really make sense because it seems haphazard, it seems slapdash, and there's always more people critiquing it from the left than the right. So what's the point? But the point is in this sort of rewriting of culture. You can see it in its grossest and most truly evil terms in England, right? Where they're reworking historical Britain and you know, turning it into a multicultural paradise with a black Hadrian and the like. It's an all pervasive view, and it has deep roots into left totalitarianism.
Absolutely. A lot of it, as you're saying, is kind of an attempt to rewrite the past into a way that fits with the left's conception of reality, and it's in line with their agenda. The war on the past is one that is very troubling to me, because, if I have confidence that, you know, whatever the alt-right, the dissident right, whatever you want to call kind of the greater response or to cultural Marxism, to globalism, I have confidence that we are going to win. But, you know, thinking about what a world would be like, you know, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years down the line with the left getting into power and continuing to install its agenda, people are going to have just a profoundly warped understanding of the past. And that is very frightening to me, because that's pretty much having all of human civilization be essentially hidden for the rest of human civilization if they win, right? That's terrifying.
It may sound callous, but go with me here. I actually think it's worse than white genocide. The elimination of an entire civilization's art and history and culture, I actually think is more evil than the elimination of the people. Because you're not talking about physical bodies and beings. You're talking about a people's conception and celebration and exploration of the divine, right? And this, of course, this is coming from someone who views art in a very specific way. But when you're dealing with this, it really is something that puts me in a mood that I dare not speak, right? And of course, like, look, I'm not talking about like a black Marvel character or sweeping out the races of a movie. I'm talking about like actual art, right? And this is something that is underway. This is something that they are doing, and it is absolutely, it's beyond vile. It's beyond, it's grotesque.
Yeah, we're seeing that now with the statues. I think since Charlottesville, the left has really been kicked into overdrive, and I think they're far more open now than they were a month ago about the fact that it isn't just about Confederate monuments, right? That was, we all knew that was just a justification. It was something that was more controversial. And, you know, hearing the more, and of course the more liberal, at least ostensibly liberal ones were talking about how, you know, it's not about racism. It's because, you know, the Confederates were, traitors to America. They were terrorists. So it's all about finding what is the most susceptible to public opinion, and you know, the Confederate monument stuff is obviously it's far easier to go with, it's far easier to sell. But now there was the CNN analyst, the black woman, who recently said something about how, you know, we need to take down, or we need to really rethink having statues of, you know, Washington and Jefferson up. So I don't want to get too far into that particular issue, because it's one that I've talked about a lot recently on Red Ice. But yeah, I mean, after American statues, what's next? I mean, once the mob mentality takes over, it's just going to be full blown, you know, ADIQ primitive iconoclasm of just really just destroying anything that, Socrates, smash that, Shakespeare, just they hate white people, they hate Western civilization, and frankly, unless we do something, it's going to keep happening. So,
yeah, it won't end with our elimination, right? It'll end in our erasure, which I think is far more.
Yeah, and that's why I like the term the Great Erasure, or just kind of the erasure, a little better than white genocide, although white genocide has, you know, red-pilled many people. But yeah, just erasure is, because that is what they are doing to us. It is, they're erasing us in on every, you know, plane of our existence, in every realm that our people exist, you know, art, in terms of art, in terms of architecture, in terms of history. They're erasing us politically, economically, and of course, you know, physically. That is kind of the key to their victory. It's amazing that people, on the one hand, will say that white genocide is some loony conspiracy theory, but then they'll turn around and say that, you know, everyone's going to be brown in 200 years, largely thanks to, you know, mass immigration and you know, people becoming more liberal and miscegenating, and you know, that's a good thing. But yeah, white genocide is a topic that could, you know, make show after show about. So I think we should start wrapping up. Why don't we talk about what an all-female island would look like, given that that's kind of the premise of this Lord of the Flies revamp. And I've been seeing feminists on Twitter posting pictures of, you know, highly, like, advanced, like, archaeo-futurist-looking tribal, you know, tropical societies with all women as saying, you know, this is clearly what would happen if women were in charge. So, gentlemen, why don't you each take a turn kind of talking about what you think an all-female tribal island society would look like.
I mean, isn't we already have that, right? That's it's just England, isn't it?
Wow, that was the Anglos will not recover from that one. But I'm almost entirely of Irish heritage, so I do support the Anglo.
there you go.
Yeah, I would say if you want to have an image of an all-female island, just transpose or transport your local cafe poetry session onto a tropical island, and that's basically what you'll have.
Right. So a lot of talking, a lot of feelings being expressed, but perhaps
a lot of body positivity.
Well, I mean, body positivity, if you're starving on an island, would be more like, hey, you might look like a Holocaust survivor, but you look just great the way you are. You know, I mean, I can't imagine, you know, you're on a desert island and everyone's starving that they'd be like, hey, you know, you're, those love handles are okay, right? Because not a lot to go around there. But, gentlemen.
The season's fashion is always heroin chic on a tropical island with feminists.
Right. Well, at least they won't have to. They won't have to worry about, you know, picking out clothes and stuff too much too, because they'll have the stuff that would be on their backs when they land there, and then they might make some makeshift, you know, maybe some makeshift dresses or some kind of primitive coverings. But yeah, I think ladies, to all female listeners, I don't think an all female desert island would work out too well. You know, historically, matriarchal societies are just pretty terrible. There are a lot of things that all women, a group of women, could do very well and perhaps could do far better than men. But yeah, I think just surviving on a desert island, that's kind of, you need some masculinity there. You need some kind of, you know, I mean, it's man versus nature for a reason. You need men who are going to go out and just, like, you know, get, you know, throw haymakers at bears and do whatever else. Just, but yeah.
Well, speaking of that, I actually wonder how they're going to treat the ending. Because for those who haven't read the book, I believe, and this is, again, I'm relying on 10 plus years of memory here, which is very risky, but on my part, but I'm going to have a go at it. I do believe that the boys in the book are rescued by a submarine crew. So I'm wondering if they're going to have the submarine crew be all women as well, because...
Because if they don't, then it's...
Exactly. And if you want to, if a all-female island is a horror show, can you imagine an all-female submarine? Like, can you just imagine, like, women in small enclosures forced to live amongst each other? Like, that has to be just terrifying. That has to be a terrifying experience.
Yeah,
I'd rather see a movie about that, like a horror movie.
Yeah, right. Or like one guy gets trapped on there so that, you know, the male viewer could imagine himself being stuck in that. But
nothing but gossip. It's awful.
Yeah. All right, gentlemen. Well, thank you for coming on. I think we had a pretty good show. We covered some very humorous topics, but I think we got some very good, you know, very deep, kind of insightful conversation out of it. So that's important. So why don't you guys go ahead and tell everyone where they can find some of your stuff on the internet?
Sure. Well, you can find me on Twitter at Marble Made Flesh. And also you can find my podcast, Kultocom, on TRS as well as Hyperboreum.com. And Rudy, why don't you plug our other show?
Yeah. So for the past few months, we've been working on a sort of humor horror kind of goes all over the place podcast. We call it Tales from the Trough. And it's an all Ovenmen production. We're on Spreaker after we got kicked off of SoundCloud with everybody else, even though I don't think we really violated any of the terms of use. But
just yeah. Decency, just moral decency.
Yeah, just decency. but yeah, I mean, you can just search Tales from the Trough, and that's T-R-O-U-G-H. I think we have a new episode coming out next week. Is that right?
Hopefully.
Hopefully, yeah. It takes a while. We do all the content ourselves, all the writing and acting and music making. So.
Nice. Yeah, well, our listeners should definitely check out Kulturkampf and Tales of the Trough if they haven't already. But, gentlemen, thanks again for coming on the show. I'll have to have you back at some point to discuss further developments in Clown World.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure.
Definitely. Thanks.